Welcome to What in God's Name. He's Chris Owen.
She is Shayna Appel.
And this is the podcast that seeks to address contemporary issues through theologic and philosophic lenses. And you know, Chris, I was thinking the other day that theologic or philosophic reflection, in fact, just how we think about things as people in general, is so heavily influenced by our life experiences and how we arrive at a situation. And I know I've talked a little bit about my journey from having been raised secularly Jewish to being ordained in the United Church of Christ, but I don't know that our listeners know your story, because you are not a cradle Christian either.
That's correct. You and I have share in common the fact that we were not raised as Christians.
We're come outers.
I was raised by hippie parents who were irreligious, and I found my way to Christianity in college, where I met for the first time something I didn't think existed, which was an intelligent Christian, a bunch of intelligent Christians.
They were like unicorns.
They were like unicorns indeed. And so I did not become a Christian in college, but the possibility opened in front of me. Hey, it's possible that you can be an intelligent person and a person of faith. So
it's a little disturbing that it was so refreshing to you to encounter, you know, faith at, you know, what I would consider to be fairly late in life, a faith that didn't require you to leave your brain at the door.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, that's its own.
That's a whole other show.
Exactly. That lends itself to other kinds of reflection. So this show, we do current events and culture from a theological point of view, which is a Christian point of view, but our backgrounds, Shayna, as Christians, we're open to different perspectives.
Well, I would parrot what Professor Elizabeth Nordbeck used to say all the time at Andover Newton Theological School when she was talking about the United Church of Christ and specifically about the creed. She would say the creeds are central, but they don't define the whole parameter. I mean, in the same way, I think this show would definitely be described as Christocentric, but I hope and pray it's never described as Christo-exclusive.
Absolutely. And that fits with one of our core values, which is to be curious.
And to go deep.
And to go deep.
So today, Chris, we're talking about an article that you brought to my attention called How Kleptocracy Came to America by Franklin Foer. Am I pronouncing his name
Franklin
correctly?
Franklin Foer. Yes, indeed.
Franklin Foer. And the article, give us a little background about the article.
Sure. So kleptocracy, this word having to do with the rule of those who are thieves. A kleptomaniac is somebody who derives great pleasure from stealing. And so a kleptocracy would be
The rule by those
of,
who steal.
By those who steal. Thank you for your clarity.
I hate to be the angel of darkness here, but that's...
So the link for this article is up on our Facebook page and our website if you care to read the article, but you don't have to read the article to follow along in our conversation today. We're using this article simply as a jumping off point. Franklin Foer's thesis is that over the last 25 years, America has become a haven for global plundered wealth. So Shayna, if you are a Russian oligarch and you're skimming tens of millions of dollars off your country's mineral wealth, one convenient way to launder that money is to buy expensive Manhattan real estate.
Or nowadays, Boston as well.
And so I'm going to quote Franklin Foer. Again, this is just to give you a little taste of what this article is about. Here's what Franklin Foer says. He says, officials around the world have always looted their country's coffers and accumulated bribes. So it's always been going on, he says. But the globalization of banking made the export of their ill-gotten money far more convenient than it had been. By one estimate, more than $1 trillion exits the world's developing countries each year. So that's $1 trillion each year exiting developing countries in the forms of laundered money and evaded taxes. Franklin Foer goes on to say, as in the Russian case, much of this plundered wealth finds its way to the United States. New York, Los Angeles, and Miami have joined London as the world's most desired destinations for laundered money. This boom has enriched the American elites who have enabled it, and it has degraded the nation's political and social mores in the process. While everyone else was heralding an emergent globalist world that would take on the best values of America. So this was Franklin Foer's alluding to the optimism of the 1990s when the Soviet Union collapsed, and this whole idea of the end of history, as Francis Fukuyama famously coined that phrase in his book, the end of history being that we've reached this pinnacle of democratic, capitalist, free societies, open societies, rule of law. Like, that's going to triumph in the world. Franklin Foer is saying, well, everyone was optimistic about that in the 1990s. What's really happened is something less optimistic, that the values of the kleptocrats, this is, again, Franklin Foer's now his words again, that the values of the kleptocrats would become America's own.
You know, just in the little snippet at the beginning of the article, when the USSR collapsed, Washington bet on the global spread of democratic capitalist values and lost. Instead, plutocratic graft has corroded American politics and business. So, God, there's so many different ways we could go with
there's
this,
a lot
Chris.
Of ways
Where
to
do
go
you
with
want to
this.
Start?
Yeah, so the values, Franklin Foer talks about values, and that's something that we talk about on this show. The values of this kleptocratic cadre that's transnational and that is finding the United States to be a really conducive place to hide this shadowy, ill-gotten money. The values are, and you can help me out with the words here, but someone who's plundering public wealth for private gain is into domination, is into accumulation for the self, and to hell with everything and everyone else. There's no care for the wider good, the public.
Absolutely.
The public trust.
Right.
It's stealing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's stealing what is common or ought to be common. I will make it my own. This is a spirit of cupidity. I love this word cupidity, which is excessive greed. So that's where I would start. The article being a jumping off place for us to consider these values or lack of values, or what do these values lead to if the value is me, myself, mine, accumulate, dominate at the expense of others.
When you were speaking, Chris, the thing that kept coming to my mind is a little something that pharmacologists know all about. It's called lock and key. So there are certain diseases that manifest in the body like a lock, and drugs that are specifically targeted for those diseases are the key. So if you don't have the disease, the drug won't work. And it feels to me like in some way there had to be a lock in American democracy that was a fit for the key of kleptocracy. And I would suggest that there has been an idolatry of capitalism throughout that has made this possible, an idolatry of the free market and what the free market would be able to accomplish and what the free market or financial wealth entitles one to, that has blinded us to the greater, the common good.
I would refine that a little bit. I wouldn't say that it's capitalism and free markets, because this kleptocracy is actually the opposite of a free market. There's no transparency. There's hiding. What they have in common is this lifting up of money as a false idol.
But you have all these realtors here in America who are willing to take all of this money in. We have a massive housing shortage in Boston. But you've got all these landlords who are taking huge money on these extraordinarily expensive condominiums that are sitting empty. And my understanding is the same thing's happening in Manhattan. So there is something inherent in our system that invited that, or that the safety, the stop, the this is really not a right or good thing to do was not inherent in the system.
Yeah, no, and I loved your analogy of the key, and I think that's right. I think you're absolutely right about that, but I wouldn't trace that to capitalism per se. I would trace it to sinfulness.
Yes, absolutely.
So let me say a little bit about that, because some of our listeners, when they hear the word sin, will just go, and recoil, and for good reason, because the word has been misused and abused to the point where it's almost not even worth using.
Oh,
I'll say what I mean by sinfulness, and then
I think there are certain elements in our faith tradition that have corrupted it. I would suggest corrupted it, but they've used it in their own particular way, and I don't think it's helpful. I think there's other more helpful ways. I would hate to lose the word.
And here's what I mean by human sinfulness. The human propensity to mess up,
mm-hmm,
based on overweening self-regard. So too much self-regard, too much selfishness, and how we mess up, how we break relationships.
Well, and again, that goes back to sort of what is the key inherent in our system? And we have for so long had this sort of mythos of individualism in America that, you know, everyone pulls themselves up by their bootstraps. You know, we hear the expression, you know, he's a self-made man. I built this, as if anyone could do anything alone, much less built a multi-million dollar corporation. Or multi-billion dollars as they are these days, I guess.
Yeah, so this hyper-individualism in our culture makes for fertile ground for our being receptive
to
this plundered wealth being parked here in banks and through shell companies, mm-hmm. as Franklin Foer details in his article, and in this real estate.
I mean, I think it's interesting. It's interesting to me that you have people out there in the world who are selling fentanyl, and they're selling opioids, and they're selling heroin. And now we've decided, in some states, it's been decided that if said person sells me something that kills me, that person can be tried for murder. Okay, good. What happens when a company does that? What happens when an entire industry, pharmacologic or otherwise, manufactures a product without regard to the well-being of the people who are going to use it, and they end up dying as a result of it? And, you know, there was all this argument about, oh, well, corporations are people. Well, fine, let's put them to death, too. I mean, there seems to be this place at which corporations and business are exempt from fundamental, not legal laws, I guess I would say God's laws, about what is right and good and furthers the common good. I guess what I'm trying to get at is it seems to me that there is the key exists within American democracy, and we have to really look at it and be willing to look at it with an open mind to see where was the receptor, what made it fertile ground for, you know, for these kleptocrats to come in here and do this, and not only do it, but then like a cancer erode our highest ideals, our morals and values.
One of the larger theological questions in this is, again, the sense of individuals making decisions, choosing to live their lives in a way that furthers their gain at the expense of others.
Absolutely.
Okay, so that plays out in a lot of ways. And I see that that's never going to be resolved. It's just going to be, for as long as we can imagine, two forces against each other. It's the force of private gain over the public good.
It's the archetypal battle of good and evil when you come right down to it. And the democracy alone is not enough to keep it in check. And I guess, you know, one of the places that I'm inclined to go, and I, you know, listeners are probably pretty aware of my biases. I am an ordained minister. I do participate in organized religion. You know, once upon a time, it is said there were three stools in America, or a stool with three legs. One of the legs was the home, one of the legs was the school, one of the legs was the church. And ethics and morality were discussed in some way, shape, or form, you know, in each one of those institutions. So, you know, decline in attendance at church, the inability to have these conversations at school, and then families, many of whom are broken, many of whom are struggling, there is no basis for a conversation of morality or ethics. So the whole ship is just drifting further and further away, and the democracy is not enough to bring it back.
I agree with that. Thank you. That is helpful to me. And again, I come back to this image, this metaphor that you've introduced about the receptor and what is the receptor. And I think there is something in the human being, this sinfulness, this propensity to be selfish, and to break relationships as a result of our selfishness.
Oh, there absolutely is, which...
That dovetails beautifully with your depiction of the decline of our ability to talk about that and to talk about it, to understand it. We don't have places to talk about morality. There's no cultural infrastructure for us to come to terms with human sinfulness.
Yeah, and I mean... You know, not for nothing, the church hasn't been always the flagship for that either. I mean, we have, you know, the church is made up of people. People are imperfect, therefore the church is imperfect, and it always has been.
Human sinfulness is in the church, in the institutional church. There's no escape from this human sinfulness. You know, the church can be one of the most evil places because religious people can hide behind God, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. hide behind the clerical robe.
One of the many things that the smart church threw out like a baby with the bathwater is talk about Satan. You know, we don't talk about sin, and we don't talk about Satan. And so by virtue of not talking about sin and Satan, we don't talk about temptation. We don't talk about how hard it is to do the right thing. We have lost the capacity to testify to our own fallenness. Like, these are all things, these are sort of like old things, and oh, we don't do that in our church. We sure as heck don't do it in the Unitarian Universalist Church. And the problem with that is, like, when you're learning, you're a sailor. I mean, when you're learning to sail, you learn to beware of the rocks, you know, the icebergs, even and especially the ones that you cannot see. There is a conversation about that. So you're at least looking for them when you're out there. If no one ever told you about an iceberg, nobody ever told you about a rocky shoal, boats would just be, and once upon a time they were, they would just ride up on them and blast apart because they didn't know any better. It just feels to me like in the absence of that conversation, it's hard to put on our armor, to arm ourselves against the natural capacity for human beings to sin.
I couldn't agree with you more, and I think that's part of the strength that you and I have as converts to Christianity. There is in the progressive church this kind of, sin and evil, these are not concepts that a rational person can believe in. Ironically, and you're just so right, Shana, losing that vocabulary. You've talked about the importance of words in naming. Mm. When we name things, we can understand them, we conceptualize them. They actually exist because we can name them. And when we lose the vocabulary of sin and evil, then we, again, your metaphor of navigation, we lose a tool, we lose our compass to help us navigate through. And so evil, I see evil as the consequence of sin. So sin is this selfishness and the breaking of relationships that happens, and then evil actions arise out of that. I mean, we have this horrible disaster of gun violence, mass shootings in our country. If you don't have the category of evil, how do you understand these things? And, well, I mean, but imagine.
But that's a perfect example, because we understand it up against the backdrop of the Constitution, right? I mean, and that's all there is. That's all there is. There's a government document that says that some people interpret to mean we have a right to bear arms, period, end of conversation.
Right, and there's this whole other dimension.
That we can't even have a conversation. We can't even get to that conversation.
Yes. And the connection there between sin and evil is in the moment of the evil deed happening, there is absolutely no regard for the other. So now a little psychology.
Oh, like Chris, I love that. That is actually the best definition of evil I have ever heard. We could just, evil is the absolute
disregard
for the other.
For the other. And I have found myself at various times in life, you know, I can be in so much pain, so much fear, so much anger, that all I can see is my own fear, pain, and anger. And I can't see anything or anybody else. And when you get into that place, there's almost nothing else. There is nothing else that matters except to find relief from that fear, pain, or anger, which might include causing harm to other people.
I think the thing that prevents me from even pitching too deeply into that space is this profound awareness of God with me. So God is here, and then a reconnection to all the stories, right? You know, because if God is here, then so is Scripture. The struggles of the early Hebrew people as they, you know, ran out of Egypt. Almost like the presence of God then becomes the keyhole through which I go and get reconnected. Without those stories, without that presence, I think it would be really easy to go through another keyhole that said either I'm going to do great harm to myself or somebody else. I don't know. I'd be very curious to know how our listeners feel about that. In the long, dark night of the soul, what helped the daybreak? What carried you through? And I'm always interested in those stories, both from people of faith and people who are not necessarily wouldn't identify themselves as faithful, maybe identify as spiritual or not. But there's something there. There has to be something that reminds us of the architecture of our interdependence. You know, I feel the same way about the country. We're lacking, again, you and I keep coming back to this place of, you know, the lack of a national narrative.
It's so interesting you bring that up because What I mean by that is...
In the beginning was the word, man.
The need for a narrative that can convey a sense of meaning, a larger purpose to culture and society.
Nothing comes into being without the word. And here's the challenge, because I think in some respects, this great experiment called America certainly started out trying to... The idea of America, not the actual practice, but the idea of America was that we would honor the differences and yet weave together a common narrative. And I'm reminded of that place, you know, in Genesis, how it seems to kind of start twice. Because there was one group who had started to tell a story, and then this other group wandered out of the desert and said, holy cow, you guys are never going to believe what we've been through. But they were a people who were settling a new land, realizing that they needed a common narrative if they were going to come together.
And so to bring this back to kleptocracy and the article by Franklin Foer, in the absence of a narrative, in the absence of a sense of a higher meaning or a deeper purpose, we revert to the lowest common denominator, which is, I'm going to get mine.
And more, I'm going to get mine, and I don't care what it does to you or to the millions of people, because these people... These kleptocrats have bankrupted nations.
Yeah, and Franklin Foer's article, again, we recommend it to you if you want to get into the details of this, but his thesis is that America has become a haven for this plundered money, and then what does that mean for who we are as a people and as a nation going forward? Provocative, very provocative, certainly lends itself to this kind of conversation where, in terms of theology...
I think the folks from Black Lives Matter had it right when they said, you know, this is a time we need to stay woke. You know, they were talking about not getting sucked into the dog whistling and gaslighting that's going on, but look past what's being broadcast, get the facts, work hard to know what's going on around you. You know, going back to the analogy of sailing, it's like, you know, somebody's got to teach you about icebergs and you know, rocky shoals, or your ship ain't going far. So somebody's got to keep the night watch. Somebody's got to look out for that stuff. And today it's up to all of us.
Indeed, and it reminds us that it's important to be curious.
Go deep.
And to shed some light.
Good to be with you again, Chris.
Ah, Shana, so fantastic to have this conversation with you. We invite our listeners always. We are available on Facebook, What in God's Name. We have an Instagram page curating little philosophical tidbits at What in God's. We love hearing from you. Send us an email through our website, which is whatingods.com, whatingods.
See you next week, Chris.
See you next week, Shana.